Lexington's morning news continues on News Talk 590 WVLK. And now, here's Jack Patty.
Good morning. Welcome to Forensic Friday and American DA Live. It's the fifth day of July, and we welcome you to it. Brought to you by Landscaper's Corner, located in Lexington at 1305 Old Frankfort Pike. Landscaper's Corner has the largest selection of natural stone in our area. Call 225-9433. Ray Larson, good morning.
Good morning, Jack.
How are you this morning?
Well, I'm tap dancing.
That's good. I ran into a young lady, I'm going to guess she was 25 years old, and she said, I want to let you know I listen to you every morning. And I said, thank you very much. And she said, I also probably like the best of anything that you have on, Ray Larson. She said, now, you're not on with him, are you? I said, no, I'm not.
Yeah, right.
Ray has so overshadowed me.
Yeah, right.
But I was very nice. It was very nice to hear that. And I hear that a lot, that people like the show on Friday mornings.
Tom Preston, who was on last week,
yeah,
talking about terrorism and counterterrorism, sent me an email and said that he didn't get a block before somebody called him up.
Good.
Then he had all kind of emails, and then he had people coming up to him at lunch talking to him about the show.
Excellent.
So that's nice to hear.
Sure. Yeah. And we got a good one today. Tell us what's up here.
Well, Dan Laren, who's a superstar assistant Commonwealth attorney.
He's a good one.
Yeah, well, no more money on that, Dan. Just is with us today, as is Scott Lynch with the Lexington Division of Police. Scott, for many years, was the coordinator of the Collision Reconstruction Unit, and then he fired that bunch and was transferred. Now he's in the Horse Patrol, and I'd like to talk a little bit about that as if we have time.
Scott's been with us before.
Well, Scott's been with us a lot,
yeah,
and Scott's a very impressive police officer, and we in Lexington are proud to have him as representing us. Dan, this was this case is Stephen Aguilar, and why don't you, first of all, let's introduce everybody to you. You've been on a lot, but some people haven't heard. Where are you from?
Well, I was born in Columbus, Ohio. I grew up in Michigan. After a couple of career twists, I decided to go to law school. I went to law school here at the University of Kentucky, and other than a brief 9 months then in Paintsville, Kentucky, as a prosecutor, I've spent the rest of the time here in Lexington.
Well, now tell me about what's the difference between crime fighting in Paintsville, which is Johnson County,
it certainly
and
is.
Crime fighting in downtown Metro Lexington.
Well, the caseload here is significantly higher. I was 50% of the staff when I worked in Paintsville, and now I'm one of, I think, about 17 or 18 very experienced and excellent prosecutors, and I'm proud to be part of the team here.
I bought an MGB from a guy in Paintsville one time.
Is that a car?
It was the only MGB in Paintsville.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. That's
almost got it back to town.
Oh, great.
Well, it was an interesting transition.
All right, so tell us a little bit about this case. You didn't get it originally.
No, sir. This case came to me. I was the third prosecutor in on this.
Does that work? Why are you the third prosecutor?
Well, we had some turnover in the office. The original prosecutor left to take another job. I think he wanted to make some more money. How that turned out.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second prosecutor left the office as well. So by the time I got this case, it had been indicted and had been worked on quite a bit by these other prosecutors.
Well, when did it happen?
This took place in April of 2012. It was April 15th, and it started out as a, I don't know if I can say a standard, but it started out as a DUI collision arrest. This was about 6 o'clock in the afternoon. There were several witnesses on Malibu Drive, which is over just off of Nicholasville Road, and they observed one vehicle that was driving slightly faster than the posted speed limit cross the center line and cause a head-on collision with a second vehicle. The woman driving.
Well, this is in a residential area.
Yes, it is.
That's kind of unusual, really, for these vehicular cases, isn't it, Scott?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Okay.
So there's the head-on crash. The vehicles are both significantly damaged. The Unit 1, as I've learned it's called, the vehicle that the defendant was driving, went up into the...
At fault.
That's
Unit
right.
Unit 1 is at fault.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And so that vehicle wound up in the front yard of one of the homes. The witnesses approached to see if they could help. The patrol officers got there pretty quickly, and the driver of Unit 1 turned out to be this Stephen Aguilar. He was kind of out of it, didn't appear to know what had happened, didn't really make a lot of statements at the scene. So the victim was removed from her vehicle, transported to the hospital. Aguilar was given field sobriety tests, which he failed. He was arrested for the DUI, transported to the jail, where he took a breathalyzer test, and the result on that was .151.
Okay, now let's stop a minute. Okay, so a collision occurs in this neighborhood on Malibu, and so what happens is the guy is arrested for suspected DUI. Now, who shows up to take care of this woman, the victim driving that was in the other car?
She was transported to the hospital by the Lexington Fire Department, by the emergency crews that responded.
Was she conscious at the time? Or?
I believe she was. She was in a fairly significant amount of pain, and she was transported to the hospital, and her injuries were very significant and came into play later.
Let's get to those in a minute.
Right.
But, so this is not a case that the collision reconstruction unit was called to immediately. Is that right, Scott?
That's correct. It was probably 24 hours, maybe 48 hours later before I became aware of this collision and got involved in it.
Okay, now this, see what happens, Jack. On occasion, things almost kind of, you don't want to say that slip through the cracks, but this is a case that the collision reconstruction unit should have been called immediately because it was a serious injury. Maybe they didn't know it was a serious injury at the time, and that's the reason, but serious assaults and deaths involved in car crashes is something that the collision reconstruction unit responds to.
That is correct, and the officers that were at the scene that night indicated to me that they just did not realize that Ms. Stouffer was that significantly injured at the time.
Okay, see, so that kind of turns out she was injured. Now, what kind of problems does the fact that it's 24 hours later before somebody gets involved from Collision Reconstruction Unit, and Dan, you chime in whenever you're comfortable on this part. But what kind of problems does that create, Scott?
Well, from the evidence gathering standpoint, obviously I would like to be at the scene of the collision. I'd like to see how the vehicles came to rest.
Why is that important?
Well, it can become important for a lot of reasons. There's a lot of evidence there in the way they came to rest and their positioning. I'd also like to be able to mark things at the roadway to measure things.
Skid marks and that kind of thing?
Well, skid marks, how far... objects and vehicles and various components of the collision, how far they moved and the impact.
You can determine, I remember doing a show on this before, you can even determine how fast cars were going, right?
Yes.
I think that's really interesting.
In many cases, but when you get there a day or two later,
yeah.
I've lost a lot of those opportunities. Mm-hmm. So
one of the fascinating thing to me is you have things like crush, the damage to cars, and as Scott says, cars run into each other, and there are laws of physics that indicate that they bounce off each other, and the laws of physics come into play, and they can make some determinations based on how far a car is bounced off the other car.
Yeah.
And that's they lost all of that. So, what do you do when 24 hours or 48 hours later they say, okay, CRU, let's see what you can do with this?
Well, in this particular case, one of the things that I thought was most important, first of all, is let's figure out where these cars are because they still have some evidentiary value, and I needed to get control of these pieces of evidence. So that was one of the first things. We executed some search warrants. Fortunately, one of the cars, if I recall, was still at Bluegrass Towing. That was the victim, Ms. Stouffer's car. And the other car, Mr. Aguilar, he had removed his vehicle, and it was at his place of employment.
Mm-hmm.
So we got...
So you got both vehicles.
Correct. And so that was crucial in my mind because I hadn't had an opportunity to see the vehicles, didn't know what type of evidentiary value they would have. So we were able to take possession of those.
Was there anything at the scene that was still of value?
Very, very little at the scene. For evidence at the scene, of course, I had the initial responding officers and their statements.
Nothing like messed up yard or bushes knocked over or anything like that?
There were, you know, a few tire marks, things of that nature, but all the things that I would have liked to have been able, you know, debris and everything has already been swept up and cleaned.
Gotcha.
Fortunately, in this case, I did have two witnesses.
Okay.
Let's take a break and come back and talk about that. 253-5959. We are back with a couple of guests this morning. Of course, Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson is with us, along with Assistant Commonwealth Attorney Dan Laren, Officer Scott Lynch with the Lexington Police Department, talking about a case that crash that happened in 2012, and take it from there, Ray.
Okay, Scott. First of all, when we took the break, you were getting ready to tell us there were a couple of witnesses.
Yeah, fortunately in this case, there were a couple of witnesses to the collision, and so we relied on their statements.
What did they have to say?
They were following the victim, Ms. Stouffer, a couple of cars back. So they actually saw, both of these gentlemen saw the collision, the impact. They clearly both said that Mr. Aguilar, who was the at-fault driver, crossed the center line, described how he crossed the center line and struck Ms. Stouffer's vehicle in her lane. They also described the direction that both these vehicles were traveling, and so I was able to take their statements, one being the important component they both agreed of where the impact happened on the roadway, and then look at how the cars came to rest as described by the officer at the scene and kind of verify that their statement coincided with what evidence I had of the scene.
Speed wasn't that big of a factor in this thing.
It wasn't a great factor. Ms. Stouffer, I was later able to determine, was doing about 29 miles an hour, and Mr. Aguilar was doing a little bit faster than that. He was doing about 43.
What was the speed limit in that area?
The speed limit's 35 on that particular road. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a great factor. What was the bigger factor was the way the two cars came together, and that the significance of that head-on impact. Ms. Stouffer's vehicle was drastically redirected, and that's where a great majority of her injuries came from.
Okay, now, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
talk to me a little bit about the training that you have to go through. I mean, you can't just come up and just, you know, lick your finger and hold it in the air. What do you have to do to...
Well, I think, first of all, you have to have a great desire to do this kind of work. I was very fortunate. In about 1997, I started getting training and reconstruction work. For our agency, first of all, we go to IPTM, the Institute of Police Technology and Management, Northwestern, or used to be the Department of Criminal Justice Training, and we do what we call the basic training portion of this, which is really three courses. You have an at-scene course, which is 2 weeks, an advanced course, which is 2 weeks, and then a reconstruction course, also 2 weeks. And that's what we would consider the basic requirement to become a reconstructionist. And then from there, you have numerous specialized trainings. You have training in vehicular and pedestrian collisions. That's usually about a week. Vehicular and motorcycle. The up-and-coming airbag technology, there's weak training in how to read and decipher those components that control the airbags.
You know something interesting, Jack? When you go to a vehicle-pedestrian collision, one of the things I've learned from these guys is where you hit, where the pedestrian hits on the windshield, because they come over the front, over the hood, and they hit the windshield. If it hit it low in the windshield, then the speed is slower. If they hit it higher, the speed is higher. It just, it's really fascinating stuff.
We're going to take a break. 253-5959, touch star 590 from AT&T. Toll free from anywhere, 1-877-777-0590, or email jackpatty@wvlkam.com. 23 minutes before 10, 253-5959, touch star 590 from AT&T. Toll free from anywhere, 1-877-777-0590, or email jackpatty@wvlkam.com. We have Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson with us, Assistant Commonwealth Attorney Dan Laren, and Officer Scott Lynch. Ray?
Dan, you're the prosecutor in this case, and this guy has been charged with what?
Well, he was charged with the DUI, and he was charged with felony assault. The elements of the assault are to wantonly cause physical injury to another person by means of a dangerous instrument or a deadly weapon. So in our case, our theory was that this defendant was wanton because he was aware of the dangers involved in drinking and driving, did it anyway, that he caused serious physical injury, as it turns out, to this victim by means of his vehicle, which is classified legally as a dangerous instrument. So he was looking at a Class C felony, 5 to 10 years for the assault. The DUI is a misdemeanor offense.
Did he have previous DUIs?
His record shows that he had a DUI in 2003 and then another misdemeanor disorderly conduct. Other than that, his record was pretty clear.
I can't let assault second go by, a Class C felony in which this Ms. Stouffer suffered serious physical injuries as a result of this violent crash, right?
Absolutely.
Well, our legislature has deemed that that's not a violent crime.
That's absolutely correct.
Yeah, well, tell us about her injuries to this nonviolent crime.
Well, she was transported directly to the hospital. As it turned out, she spent almost exactly 2 months before she was released. She had fractured vertebrae in her neck and in her lumbar spine. She had a fractured sternum. She had some damage to internal organs, as well as a fair amount of bruises and contusions and things of that nature.
How old is Ms. Stouffer?
78.
At the time.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, how's she doing now?
Not very well. When we were working on this case, I was threatening the defense attorney with a trial because, in my opinion, a year is plenty of time to resolve a case like this. We talked more to her family than to her. She was in and out of treatment, was really trying to put this incident behind her, and so we dealt with her family really more. One of the detectives who assisted in the investigation here talked to her.
Who was that?
That was Detective Franz Wolf. He's one of our robbery homicide detectives. Mm-hmm. And he talked to her, and prior to this crash, she was working part-time, living by herself, driving herself around town. After the collision, she needs 24-hour care. She's not able to take care of herself. She needs help cooking and cleaning and everything. So
all as a result of this crash?
Yes.
You see, that's the crime victims are the forgotten people.
Yep.
And as a result, this woman's life, she is 78 years old. She's doing what she wants to do. Now all of a sudden, she can do almost nothing by herself. So talk to us about, what did the grand jury do?
Well, the grand jury.
And how does a grand jury work?
Well, the grand jury got this case. The police officers went back once they learned of this victim's injuries and charged the assault. And the grand jury considered the whole thing at the same time. Mr. Aguilar posted bond the same day he was arrested and did not return to custody at the same time. Mr. Aguilar posted bond the same day he was arrested and did not return to custody until the case was resolved. The grand jury considered it, returned the indictment for the felony assault and the DUI, and then he was arraigned in circuit court. It took about a year for this case to resolve.
Well, part of that is as a result of the number of attorneys that have been involved with it, I think.
That's probably fair. I know that when I was talking to the defense attorney, he gave me a lot of noise about these DUI, I think of them as defense attorney tricks, you know, these things that reasons why the breathalyzer is faulty or reasons why the sobriety tests that the patrol officer did were wrong. And I learned about all these tricks that defense attorneys like to pull to try to get their clients out of the responsibility for the injuries.
Okay, so Scott, come on in here. Tell us, so field sobriety test. So Jack Patty, let's assume for a minute that Jack Patty is picked up and suspected of DUI. Tell me what, how do the police go about determining whether or not they're probable cause to believe all that?
Well, several things. First of all, are going to be my observations. My observations of his driving characteristic, depending on why I might have stopped him. Maybe he did something like run a red light or something, and actually after I walk up to the car, I begin to have his suspicion. Or maybe I see him drifting back and forth in the roadway, something that leads me to a suspicion that potentially there's some impairment, and that's why I stop him. But I'm going to make observations at the car, what I see, what I smell. Do I see alcoholic beverage containers in the car? Do I smell alcoholic beverages?
So when the police come up to the window there, they're in the process of doing an investigation.
Correct.
Right.
There are a multitude of things going on.
I hear the biggest myth that alcoholics believe is that you can't smell vodka. That's not true.
That's not true. It still smells like an alcoholic beverage when it's emitting from your body. So I'm looking and smelling. I'm also asking for a driver's license, maybe proof of insurance, other documents. But if I begin to have a suspicion that there's impairment going on, I may ask him to do two things at once, what we call a divided attention skill. So while I'm asking for a simple thing like, do you have your driver's license with you, Mr. Patty, I may also say something like, so where are you headed to tonight? A very simple question that a normal person could easily answer while they're pulling their driver's license out, but for an impaired person, that divided attention becomes difficult. I can either get my driver's license or I can answer the question. So another indicator that maybe there's something that needs to be looked at further.
Now, what about these field sobriety tests we hear about?
Field sobriety test, contrary to the old myths that we make you say your ABCs backwards and stuff, they're actually standardized field sobriety tests. So these are tests that have been scientifically tested and quantified, and your performance is at a certain level of impairment, you expect to see certain performances. So there are a number that we do. We the one-legged stand test, the walk and turn test. We do a horizontal gaze nystagmus test, which
Now, what in the world? Horizontal gaze nystagmus test. That sounds a little...
I swear I haven't had anything to drink this morning, and I don't think I could pass that test
right now. Yeah.
So it has to do with the involuntary movement of your eyes and how well or how smoothly your eyes can track an object.
That's one you can't fake, I've heard.
Correct.
Sometimes people that are pretty drunk can fake some of the others, but that eye thing gives you away.
Well, it has to do with tolerance. Now, I mean, we typically, if you're at 0.30 or 0.32 or above, there's a... And you're in a detention center, they've got to be careful about you or send you to the emergency room, because that's a pretty significant possibility of alcohol poisoning. Now, but there are people that are serious alcoholics that have developed tolerance, and they can function at that level.
We're going to take a real quick break, our final break, and then we'll continue this. 253-5959. Touch star 590 from AT&T, toll free from anywhere, 1-877-777-0590, or email jackpatty at wvlkam.com. And we are back. It's 10 minutes away from 10 o'clock. Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson, Assistant Commonwealth Attorney Dan Laren, and Officer Scott Lynch. And we've got about 6 minutes to wrap this up, Ray.
Okay, Dan, let's... Okay, so you got the case. It's indicted as assault second degree, which is Class C felony, punishable by 5 to 10 years, as well as the DUI charge.
Right.
Tell me, so you... And you've also said something about Mrs. Stouffer.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to prosecute this case, she has to testify.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and does that create a problem for you?
It would. I knew that she did not want to testify. She was trying to put this behind her, and she was in a physical condition where it would have been difficult or not possible to bring her into the court to testify. And in my opinion, I think that's why the defense attorney wanted to keep delaying the case, so that the victim would eventually not be available and I would be forced to make him a better offer.
Now, when you say offer, what does that mean?
A plea offer to resolve the case. In this case, he was looking at between 5 and 10 years, and we talked it over, and we offered him 7 years. Basically, it was he did not deserve a minimal offer because of his record and the injuries.
Okay, so what happens? What we're saying there is, if this defendant chooses to plead guilty to the charge, assault second, we would recommend 7 years. And so that's what the offer means. Mm-hmm. And we frequently say offer instead of what really it is, a recommendation on a guilty plea.
Could the judge, even with that, come back and change it?
So he can reduce it. He can't raise it.
Okay, got it. Gotcha.
Yeah. Okay, so what happened?
Well, after dancing around with this defense attorney for a few weeks, I told him that I was going to withdraw that offer and demand a trial date, and he ended up pleading guilty. So he got a couple of months to make his best pitch to the judge for probation, and that he was sentenced to
his last
month.
To Mary Houlihan was heavily involved.
Absolutely.
In this case. We know Mary, and we know Mary is a superstar representative of the interests of crime victims in our mm-hmm. office. And so victim impact statements, what does that mean?
Well, the victim and sometimes their family have the opportunity to basically write a letter to the judge and explain what they want to happen. And I know that the judges pay a lot of attention to those because it's important to deal with the fallout from crimes like this one, the damage that was done to this woman and her family.
Well, one of the things that really is offensive to me and to victims, Jack, is when defendants are sentenced, the judge will say, "Do you have anything you want to say to the defendant?" And the defendant typically is looking for sympathy and that sort of thing. Did you know that the victims don't have, in Kentucky, do not have a right to address the judge like the criminal does?
I did know that just because of this show.
Yeah, yeah, well, and that's really, it stinks.
Yeah.
So tell us what happened.
Well, he appeared on his sentencing day. He was working as a car salesman. A lot of his friends from where he works, his family was there. He made, in my opinion, a pretty good speech. He'd clearly been coached. The judge considered all of that, considered the information that we had, and sentenced him to prison for 7 years. How that plays out is he'll be eligible for parole in 20% of his time. That'll be next November. I looked him up on the corrections website yesterday. I will be amazed if he does not ask the judge for shock probation in about 30
now
days.
Now tell us what shock probation is.
Well, shock probation is, the theory is you go to prison and you're shocked by the experience. You see the error of your ways and you decide that you're going to do the right thing. There's no point in keeping you in custody any longer. What it really is everybody that goes to prison waits 30 to 180 days, asks the judge to let him out on shock probation.
Yeah, well, and the only shock is to the victims when they realize the guy has served 30 days or 60 days and is back on the street. And as in the case of Ms. Stouffer, she is in this condition for the rest of her life.
Right.
And that's kind of, that's the shock.
Right.
So,
does he serve his time?
It'll be up to corrections. As of this morning, he's still at the Fayette County Detention Center.
Could he stay there the whole time? Most likely not.
Probably not, because it's a C felony. They'll probably put him somewhere. He'll go to the Roederer assessment facility, and then they'll send him wherever they think is best.
Well, at any rate, the thing to learn out of this one is, number one, is that this assault second is a nonviolent crime according to our legislature, and the other one is that crime victims don't have the right to speak to the judge like the criminal does, and it's just not fair, and I'll keep talking about that till I die.
Thank you, Ray. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you. Good to be here again.
Stay with us. Update from ABC is coming up.